afternoon. And I hope everybody had a wonderful Victoria Day weekend. May 2-4. And yes. I'm still getting used to it. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I'm in year 8. Year 7? Year 8? Okay. That has a Victoria Day. Okay. Then we are special. We are up to Perek Mem, chapter 40. We have made it to chapter 40. So, remember that we've seen it now, God's first speech to Eov, to Job. Job has demanded communication and an accounting from God for his suffering. And God delivers his first speech saying, first of all, you lack an understanding of the universe. This isn't, you know, something you can run. This isn't something you created. This isn't something you really understand and grasp. And further, in the second half of that speech, you pride yourselves on the civilization. You, humanity, pride yourselves on the civilization you've created. But God's world is broader. And it includes the wild side and the side which laughs at human endeavor. I didn't really play it up enough in the speech because I only noticed it as we were reading through. But 3 different times, creatures are described as laughing at civilization. And we're going to see more of that actually in God's second speech. So the emphasis here could be that God does more than we do. His power is greater. But that's really not seen so much here. There's much more of an emphasis on the beasts themselves and what the beasts do. It's not really about what God does. So I think the stronger way to understand the speech is that God's world is just very different from our world, and therefore there is no basis for communication. Can there be prophecy? Sure. But that's not the same thing as what Job is asking for. Job is not asking God to send him a message of rebuke because people are doing things wrong. God is asking him to explain what's going on, how the world operates. And so that was the first speech, and now in the second speech, oh, I forgot to take a sheet for myself. I hope there's a spare stuff. Thank you. In the second speech, I gave you the outline at the top of the page. God is going to turn to Job and say, "Answer me. You know, I've given you my perspective. I've given you my explanation. So now, Job, it's your turn to turn to me and say, you know, God, you're right." That's what he's going to say to Job. And you're going to see, obviously, there's another speech coming. So that tells you about how well that went. The themes that we're going to see here in the second speech are, first of all, God is still not angry. You don't get any sense that God is upset with Job. It's going to be more of laying out the gap between human experience and divine experience. But the big difference between the first and the second speech is that whereas the first one had many brief images, we looked at animal after bird, that which human beings think they're contributing to society and how God provides that for these wild creatures. And what we're going to see here instead are 2 extended images, 2 super creatures, the behemoth or behemoth? I don't know how they pronounce it. Behemoth land. No, not how they pronounce it in Canada. How they pronounce it, like, how do the behemoths pronounce it? The behemoth and the leviathan. So the question that I want to think about certainly within this is, number one, why do you need a second speech? What was wrong with the first one that God needs to now fix with the second one? And why are these 2 creatures singled out for a longer treatment? What are they? What is it about them that God's going to spend time on them? So we start with God turning to Job and saying, it's time for you to answer. It's on page 1675 in the Art Scroll Tanakh. After he has concluded the previous speech with this image of the birds eating the corpses, Vayan Hashem es Iyov Vayomar, and God answered Job, and he declared. Now, technically, you didn't need the sentence at all, because God was already speaking, and now he's going to continue to speak. So the commentators, Mitzudat David, Dat Mikra, all of them basically understand that that means that God paused. There's a pause for Job to absorb it, and then God says to him what he is about to say. Ibn Ezra understands that as well. And Ibn Ezra actually says, God pauses hoping Job is going to say something. And Job doesn't say anything, and so God continues. And he says, Pasuk Bet. There's a tough word in this sentence, which is the challenge. Harov im shakai yisor, mochiach eloka ya'anena. This is a hard sentence to translate because of the word yisor. The word yisor is the problem. In the art scroll, they read it as, can one who contends with the Almighty be arrogant? I don't even know where that fits in the words. Unless they're going to take rove as to be great and read that as arrogant, but none of the classic commentators read it that way. The problem with the word yisor is that it doesn't really fit. Yisor could be a function of musar, to be ethical, but yisor is a very odd way to conjugate the word. It could be like to receive rebuke, but then it should be yusar, not yisor. It could be like to offer rebuke or even to fight, taking the samach like the sin, kisarita melokim v'manashim, with Yaakov and the malach, and Rashi is going to take it that way, but it's a very hard read no matter what you do. So that Rashi will actually read this sentence as, will a person fight with God? That's the way that Rashi reads it. Ibn Ezra reads it as to be ethical, and he says, is it ethical to fight with God? Like Musar, yes. Yeah. So, Harovim Shakai Yisor is fighting, Rov, like Riv, is fighting with God ethical? I favor Mitzudat David, as usual. I like his translations. They make a real effort to fit the words, as well as the themes. And in number two, I brought you the way he reads it. Ha'im ata harav im shakai kibel musar midvarav. It should probably be yikabel, but that's the way the text is written. Will you, who quarrels with God, accept rebuke from his words? In other words, God turns to him after the first speech and says, are you going to learn anything from that which I have told you? And then the sentence continues, Mochiach Eloka, the one who rebukes God, Ya'anena, let him answer. It's time for you to provide an answer. Dav Mikra has this very funny way to read it. He reads Im Shakai Yisor as like a title for a person. Harov Im Shakai Yisor. Will the Im Shakai Yisor, will the one who quarrels with God, stand up and fight? They do that also? Okay. It's funny. I like it. It has this sort of sort of First Nations feel as a name. One who fights with God. Elisha, what were you going to say?
Do any of them translate it like they do in Hallel, someone who is like, afflicted.
Right, so I haven't seen anyone render it that way. It's an interesting question, but I haven't seen anybody translate Yisor that way. I think largely because it doesn't really fit the context well. Malvin does?
Yeah, he says in
the
reading.
Okay, so how does he read the clause?
This doesn't give me the entire... Misha Sem Rivat Im Shakai Asher Yisur, Yasur, the one quarrels with the Almighty, who I take this to be, institutes suffering.
Causes suffering, in other words.
Mochiach Eloka, the one who fears God. Eloka Mochiach, the Lord.
In which case, let's take Ya'anena.
Ya'anena.
As he knew it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so it's not
answered.
So he won't take it as Inui. He takes it as the answer. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, fundamentally, the word Yisor is a mess, and that's what causes the problem. But however you're going to render it, God turns to him and says, Job, what do you have to say? I gave you this whole speech. I talked to you about the gap between human beings and God. What do you have to say for yourself? And so in Pasuk Gimel, in sentence 3, Vayan Iyov es Hashem vayomar, Job answers God. What does he say? Hein kalosi ma'ashiveka. Kalosi could be read as, I have been shown to be light, kal, or I have been shamed. Kalon is a term for shame. Ibn Ezra says it as, I have been shamed. Mitzudat David takes it as, I have been shown to be light, meaning like a lightweight, to be frivolous. If you take a look on your sheet at number 3, I brought it there. He says, "Hina hikarti be'atzmi sheni kal ma'od." I recognize I'm a lightweight. V'lo lamadti chokhma ladas she'hakol ba b'hashgacha. I never learned wisdom to know that everything is under God's supervision. U'maza davar asher ashiv lach. So what am I going to answer you? Ki ein b'fi ma'ane, I have nothing to say. Which fits with the rest of the sentence. If you go back into the text, he's saying, I recognize it. I'm too much of a lightweight in this. What can I answer? Yadi samti lemofi. I place my hand to my mouth. A gesture of self-silencing. We saw that before, at least once, in chapter 21, sentence 5, we saw the same expression. He says, I have nothing to say. Achaz dibarti velo e'ene. I spoke once. That's good enough. I'm not going to keep on. Frankly, he spoke way more than once. But I spoke once, and that's all I got to say. Ushtayim, I spoke twice, velo osif, and I will not speak further. There are those who take deeper meanings on this because they know that Job didn't speak once. And so they render the one as a reference to this, and two as a reference to that. I didn't go into it because they didn't feel like pshat. They didn't seem to really fit. He says, I've spoken my piece. There's nothing else that I. There's nothing else for me to say. I am not going to persist. So now we have to pause and ask: has God won the debate? Is this capitulation from Job?
No, it doesn't sound like it. It sounds like he's saying, "I'm sticking to my guns. I've said it already." It doesn't sound like he has an answer to what God might be saying. Okay, I understand you now. He's saying, "I said it, and that's it. I'm not."
Okay. Why?
Like, I'm not going to respond to you. Like, you know, I don't know.
Okay.
I just don't see it as like
yeah.
You could go a little over the limb and say, P.O. says, okay, you spoke, God, didn't convince me, so I'm not going to argue with you.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with you, God. As though I didn't spend the entire book trying to do exactly that. Ralph, that's
what. He's just recognizing God's authority in God's realm.
In other words, you get to talk about this, and
he's talking about natural laws that we have no control over.
Well, take a look at Ibn Ezra, because I think he is along the lines of what people here are saying. Ibn Ezra at number 4. Kasher hishlem Hashem lehochicho, when God finished rebuking him, shasak Iyov. Job was silent, and that was what I pointed out in the beginning. What does that have to say? Vayan, because God was silent, but then Job was silent. And so God said to him, "Nu, don't you have anything to say?" And Job replied inappropriately. He said, "I'm not responding to you." So you're not going to admit the truth. You think that you're wise. So I'm going to ask you some questions, Job. And then he goes on. He launches into the second speech, and that's certainly one take. Mitzvah David is similar on it, although he does the play with the one and the two, which I said before I wasn't going to go into, but apparently I did. So take a look at number 5. Ha'achas asher dibarti bereishis amarai lekrot hagar al asher masarta kol biyad ha'maracha. When he said I spoke once, what that means is the one was what I said in the beginning. When I said, I complained that you have given everything over to the constellations, right? That's the Mitzudat David Ralbag read of the book, that Job is alleging that everything is in the hand of the stars, and that he doesn't like that. So he says, that was the one thing that I said in the beginning. Hine dibarti az, I spoke then. But I'm not going to continue and try to bolster what I said. I see, you didn't do that. Everything is in your hands because you explain what you do for all the wild animals. Clearly you are in control. But the two questions that I asked in the beginning. My question of, well, if everything is supervised by God, why is it that bad things happen to the good, good befalls the wicked? I still don't have an answer because God didn't address that at all in the speech. He says, but I'm not going to go further with that because I'm afraid to second guess you. You've made your point that you do run the world. You answered my astrology question. But you didn't actually address the things that were bothering me about the way you're running the world. So, you know, that I'm not going to push, he says. Now, from that, if you were to take it just from there, it would sound like God's approach would now have to be something new and different. Right? If you're God, and Job has said, well, I didn't like what you told me, because what you told me didn't really address what was bothering me, so you should say something different. You should try a different approach. However, we're going to see that there really isn't a substantively different approach in the second speech. It's really going to be more of the same, although with different imagery. And so what you get here, really, I really like this way of framing it. So take a look at number six. Newsom does the job for me. Perhaps a little bit more snarky than I would have said it. Since Job appears to be hard of hearing, God simply repeats the message louder and more slowly. That's pretty much what we're gonna see here. If the first speech employed the sublime mode of repetitive excess, right? This beast and this bird and this animal and whatever, the second employs that of exorbitance, because it's gonna be grand scale, you know, Behemoth and Leviathan, which I've decided on the pronunciation, so I don't have to worry anymore. But no more than in the first speech will these images be translated into conceptual discourse. In other words, God isn't going to go from that to discuss ideas with Job. Only primary images can evoke the necessary recognition and emotional response. Newsom's point is, this isn't something to be discussed and debated as ideas. This is something that has to be simply sensed and felt. And that's what God is trying to provide for Job. So don't expect that you're going to see debate. There's no debate that's going to happen here. What you're going to get instead are grander images. So let's see. Let's launch into the second speech. Vayan Hashem es Iyov min se'ara vayomar. God responds to Job from the whirlwind, right? The whirlwind, again, as we said last time, is not a destructive force. It is it's an obfuscating thing. It's there in order to say, you can't understand me, Job. You can't see past the whirlwind. Rabbeinu Bachaye, in his Kara Kemach on this, notes that there's one difference between this whirlwind and the first one. Can you see? There's one difference in the way it's presented. Yep. Elisheva got it. Shani, you going to say? Yeah, the lack of a hay. The first one was min ha-se'ara. This one is min se'ara. What's the difference?
This is a known one.
Right, the first one was. Right, ha-se'ara, the whirlwind, suggests it's the known whirlwind. This is from a whirlwind. You know, there happened to be one around. The idea is that the first one is grander and greater because Job is more distant from truth. Now, Job has at least reached the point of acknowledging something. And therefore, this is Rabbeinu Bachaye's idea, that it's not entirely obscure. Job is closer to truth. Nonetheless, the beginning is going to be the same beginning he gave last time. In sentence 7, he says to Job, Ezor nach gever chalatzecha, gird yourself like a warrior. Esh alcha vahodiyeni, I'm going to ask you questions, and you are going to answer me. And he begins not with the beasts, but he begins first by saying to Job, let's see you implement justice. You don't like my justice. Take a shot at it. He says, let's say you had all the power in the world. Ha'af tafer mishpati, I like this sentence very much. Ha'af tafer mishpati, tarshieni leman titzdak. Will you declare my justice to be void? Are you going to say that I am wicked in order that you should be righteous? This is a very strong statement. I think it's an important statement. Right? What's God saying to Job with this sentence 8? True, on a very simple level, we can't both be right. Shana?
I'm going to substitute your morality for mine.
Yeah, meaning?
You think yours is superior.
You do think yours is superior, but I think the leman is a very important word.
In order to justify your misunderstanding of things.
See, there are two ways you can argue a case, right? You can argue a case out of a desire to find truth, or you can argue a case in order to win. I don't really care what the end result is, as long as at the end of the day, everybody says he was right. And that's what God is alleging about Job. You need to declare me evil so that at the end of the day, you can say to everybody, see, I'm really a good guy.
Is that fair to Job?
You tell me.
No.
Why?
Mm-hmm. Being the victim of a net, and everything taken away from him, and now he was rebuked. Before he was rebuked by his so-called friends, and now he's being rebuked from God.
Right. So Paul asks, Job is the victim of injustice. We know because we read the opening chapters. We know full well that he is a victim of what is fundamentally unearned suffering. So. What is God doing? Well, go back to that original bet, right? What was it that God was trying to accomplish from the beginning? It was the demonstration that human beings can be fully and selflessly not only righteous, because that wasn't what Satan was concerned with, but Yirei Elokim, loyal to God. It was about loyalty. And perhaps what God is doing here, because my first reaction was like yours, like Job hasn't done anything to earn this kind of criticism. But with Job, what this book has been about, at least on some level, is the desire to prove that human beings will be loyal to God regardless of what happened to them. And he's saying to Job, where is that loyalty? Is it really just about you being right? Was the Satan right all along? Is that, you know, is that what this is? It's all just declare me bad so that you can, you know, be seen to be good? I think that's the allegation here is.
He declared God bad. He just said, I want to understand what is going on.
Well, no, he was far harsher than that, right? He said, God is my enemy. God is coming out to hurt me. God is looking for reasons to attack me. He was pretty clear about that. It took him a while to get there, but once he got there, he was there. Ralph, defender of Job.
But this,
it's good. It's a good title.
But this isn't to suggest that Job has no right to ask the question.
Correct.
He does have the right.
This is not at all against that. And I think that was one of the points that you know, we spent our first year showing, is that he starts out as someone who's fully and very loyal. He remains loyal throughout, but his visitors push him step by step to greater levels of frustration, and he expresses himself much more strongly by the end than he did in the beginning. That's why they are part of the test. How far is he going to go before he stops being loyal to God? Now, my jury is still out, as we said at the end of chapter 31, on whether Job has actually broken his loyalty or not. But I think that's the question that's being put to him. Are you loyal or aren't you? Are you going to declare me wicked so that you can win, which will put you in the Satan's camp, what he alleged, or are you still loyal? I think that leman is a very important word in this sentence. Leah.
But it's still like a very bad movie, because it isn't God who's punishing or striking Eeyore, it's the Satan. But because God steps back, God is complicit.
Right.
So it's like being in a really bad movie where the one bigwig says,
just trust me. Just trust me, it'll all be fine, like Abraham and Hashem at the beginning. And because the bigwig knows he's going to get this far from death, and then it'll be stopped. But is it fair to ask that much loyalty?
Right, and that's a very good question. I mean, that's part of the whole bet.
But throughout it, God has not come to him in a dream
and promised him anything.
Don't worry, it'll all come out in the end.
Correct. What's demanded of him in that sense is more than what's demanded of Abraham, because he has no such promise. Absolutely true. The idea that it's not God doing this is clearly a fiction. Meaning, Satan is doing it at God's instruction, and Satan exists as a function of God in the first place, as one of his agents. However much he is outside of the group in the beginning, nonetheless, he's only able to act at God's instruction, and God is the one who is empowering him to do whatever he's going to do. You know, this is what they call in the tax world an avoidance transaction. Which is not going to fool the CRA. So, no, you can't... It is God doing it, and yes, he is pushing Job very far, and the question of how fair it is part of our general comfort level with the book, or lack of comfort with the book. Susan?
It says here, no man is taken to... That is just what he says. No man is taken to account for what he speaks in distress. Because of his dire affliction, Job spoke as he did. So this comment is saying... Just the opposite of God's saying. He sort of comment says, well, Job shouldn't be blamed because he was in so much pain, and yet God is rebuking him. There's no two ways about that.
Right, so that was actually something that we saw earlier. That was actually, it's a Talmudic quote originally, and it was read into the words of Elihu, who said that. He said, Job speaks without knowledge. And it's a good apology for him. But life doesn't work that way. In other words, it may be true that you are exempt from responsibility in court because you were under duress when you did it, but it's not going to save you from being told you shouldn't say such things. That's, I think, the way that it plays out. But I think it's also part of a general overarching question, which we referred to in the beginning of the book, is it okay for Job to speak the way he does? And there really are two sides to it. No, yes, in Job.
Job, okay, but we're reading it. It's obviously meant...
No, but it's true.
And he's not giving him any space to be human, to suffer and complain. Like, we aren't angels. We do have all these flaws. He built us with flaws. And, you know, he, whatever he was. But it seems like it's not good enough for Job to be human. Should be
about humanity. Or, the way the book is presenting it, is that the goal is for this to be the ideal, the height of human achievement in this area. In other words, that's what it means. This is what the book is arguing, is that this is within the capacity of a human being. That a human being can achieve this. It's not impossible to achieve that level. I'm going to take Rita and Janine, and then we're going to go forward, because there's way too much to see here. I'm sorry. Rita.
There are people who
There are. But the question is whether you can put it on Job to say, this is what we expect of you. In other words...
But this is the whole point of the book, though, that this is that what God is trying to tell Satan, that he's not doing this just because I'm good to him. He, on a soul, that he's...
He's going to be... I mean, yes, that is part of the point of the book. Yeah. I would agree with that, yeah. Janine.
I just read these words with a slightly different nuance.
Yeah.
Which is, the word tzedaka can mean, and maybe it does mean, because I look back, the word tzedek is not used, but could it be to prove that you are a tzedek? Is the only way you can prove that you are a tzedek by accusing me of having done bad things?
Right.
It could be that I have I may have a plan that you don't even understand, but your punishment was mine. Because you were not Sadiq, and the only way you think that you can prove that you are a Sadiq is by showing that I've done.
No, I think that is part of this. I think that's absolutely part of this.
You're right, but that you're a Sadiq.
But the two go hand in hand. In other words, Job has created a binary system in which either Job is right and God is wrong, or God is right and Job is wrong. not recognizing that there's actually this other possibility, which is God has a motivation for what he's doing that is right, and Job is righteous also. Yeah, no, that's very much a part of this.
I'm more righteous.
Right, no, and I think both elements are present, but I think they end up saying the same thing. That's why I didn't spell it. But yeah, I think that both elements are relevant here. Whether it's so that you will win the debate or so that you will be seen to be righteous, you know, either way you come to the same conclusion, which is you need to incriminate God in order to preserve your narrative of I am good, or your narrative of I've won the debate. And you know, that's what I'm seeing here. I know there's more to be said, but we are half an hour in and we have to see this chapter today. So this is where we're gonna call it. Pasuk Tet, sentence 9. Don't worry, there are other things to discuss. Sentence 9. Ve'im zeroa kakel lach, if you have an arm like God, if you are mighty, uvakol kamohu tar'em, and you will thunder with a voice like God, adena ga'on v'gavoa, clothe yourself, or really crown yourself, an edi is a crown, like at Har Sinai, edi is a crown. Interestingly, edi is also a term used with pregnancy. The vatahar in Hebrew, in Aramaic, is v'adiat, the crown, perhaps. Heavy head, like hangs the head, but well, how does the light go?
Uneasy
lies the head that wears the crown. Okay, so the statement, though, is Adena, crown yourself now, Gaon v'gavoa, with power, with greatness, V'hod v'hadar tilbash, clothe yourself with glory. Hafetz avros apecha, Pasuk Yud Aleph, sentence 11. Hafetz avros apecha, Re'e chogeye, v'hashpileyu, Hafetz is to scatter. Scatter your rage, and see all those who are arrogant, and lower them. In other words, punish those who are arrogant. Let's see you set the universe right. Re'eh, bless you. Re'eh chol ge'eh, hachni'eyu. See all those who are arrogant. Hachni'eyu, and humble them. Va'adoch risha'im tachtam, and crush the wicked where they stand. Tamneim ba'afar yachad, bury them in the dirt together, pnehem chavosh batamun, and hide their faces, or bury their faces in hiding. So let's see you do all of this. Mitzudat David says, I think I brought it on your sheet, yeah, it's source number 7, do it all by decree. Gezor aleihem, decree upon them, shiflus v'hachna'a uktisha, declare upon them that they should be laid low, that they should be humble, that they should be crushed. And see if your decree is fulfilled. And then back in the pasuk, the last sentence in this section, v'gamani odeka, then I will acknowledge you too, because your right hand will act for you. What he says to Job is, I want you to play me, capital M. Well, number one, it's not fair because he doesn't have the power to do so. Sharon is correct. But number two, I find it really interesting that God picks, of all the traits of God that he wants Job to emulate, punishment. Like, how about go give nice lollipops to people who are good? You know, like, why is, you know, help the needy? Why is imitating God about punishment? I find it particularly interesting because the Talmud gives us an imperative. The Torah says you should walk in the ways of God. And the Talmud says that means you're supposed to imitate God. But it says imitate God, and then it gives examples, and all the examples are the benign ones. Be merciful on others, look out for others. It doesn't say go punishing people. Why is this the one that God chooses here?
Because Job is complaining about punishment. So God is just addressing him.
Mm-hmm.
You
complained about punishment.
You need a better job at it than I am.
Right. But Job is complaining about more than punishment, right? Job also complained about lack of good things for those who are good. It isn't as though the whole thing was about, you know, the experience of suffering. Ralph?
But it seems to me that there's an analogy here between the way the friends operate and the way God is operating.
Yeah.
On the same level. And I don't know whether that's deliberate or accidental.
I don't understand what you mean.
the approach that God is taking is similar to the approach that the friends took towards Job and Job's attitude.
I don't know. I mean, friends, they said, Job, you sinned. First they said, Job, you must have sinned, because otherwise God wouldn't be doing this to you. And then they said, no, Job, you have sinned. And at one point, even Eliphaz said, and this is what you did wrong. God has done nothing of the sort. Not once here has he said, Job, you're a bad guy.
No, but they're also talking about God's power.
Yes. Although, the truth is, Job spent more time talking about God's power than they did. Job talked a lot more about God's power than they did. They talked about God's righteousness, which Job didn't like at all. I think there may be two reasons. The element of rebuke in it. But why they focus on punishment? To me, I think there are two possible explanations that I would offer.
He's also focusing on haughtiness.
Yeah.
He mentioned it twice.
Oh, yeah. After telling him to clothe himself in it.
Is this in any way a rebuke to?
I don't think it's. I don't see it as a rebuke to Job. I think it is a statement in general, going back to what Job did earlier, that it's a major human failing, which Job identified as well. In other words, that's been a theme in the book in general, this anti-arrogance theme, and everybody, Job included, has spoken about it. I think Job established himself in the beginning already of the book and onward through the book as a purveyor of chesed, of kindness. He talked about how he took care of the orphans, he talked about how he took care of the widows, he talked about how he saw people in need and he gave to them, he took them into his house. You know, Job already has established himself as a purveyor of kindness. And God is now saying to him, you know, running the world is about more than just giving people nice things. You also have to know when to punish. Can you do that? I think that might be one explanation. I think it also might go back, though, to the second round of speeches. The second round of speeches, all of the visitors focused on punishment of the wicked as a way to demonstrate that there is justice in the world. And maybe God is echoing that and saying, new Job, do you do that? Do you punish the wicked? That could be also. I don't know. But it's an interesting thing that he does, certainly. But now we get to the main attraction of this speech, which is these two creatures. So as we get into this, we have to ask ourselves a question, or really two questions. Question number one, are these real creatures that we're going to talk about? This Behemoth and Leviathan, that's question number one. And question number two is, what is God's point in highlighting them? So in terms of the first question, are these real? As you read it, if you read the text literally straight through, Behemoth seems to be a normal creature, if a very large creature. It is often rendered, in fact, as, anybody see anywhere?
Hippopotamus.
It is often rendered as a hippo, which is very funny, because as a kid you grew up thinking of hippos as this nice, benign, you know, creatures, hungry, hungry hippos, and that kind of thing. And then, if you ever actually look at them, no, the hippo is not your friend. The hippo is this gargantuan creature, and quite a frightening creature. And the Leviathan is rendered, generally speaking, as a crocodile or an alligator, is the way that that I've seen it rendered. It's this very strong leather... Sorry? No, I've never seen it rendered as a whale. I mean, I've heard people use the term in modern Hebrew, but I've never seen anybody commenting on Job render it as a whale. Generally, it's crocodile or alligator, which makes sense, much more than whale, because it's a strong creature, but it's also a leather-bodied creature. It's like armored. It is a sea dweller, or water dweller anyway, and it has fearsome teeth. That's played up here. So, yeah.
Dinosaurs?
I'm sorry?
Dinosaurs?
I don't think Job saw dinosaurs. I'm pretty sure that they're separate from human beings. The idea that it's a regular creature, but it's, you know, hippo or crocodile, or I would get caught up on which one is the crocodile, which one is the alligator. Don't explain it to me, I'm just going to forget. But in the association with these makes sense in terms of their fearsome size and strength. There is no predator for an adult hippo. None. There's nothing on the food chain that's going to hurt an adult hippo. A young hippopotamus can be attacked by a crocodile or a lion, but as soon as the mother shows up, that's it. It's over. They have videos on YouTube. It's not pretty. Ibn Ezra actually says that there are some people who say that the behemoth is an elephant because there'll be a reference to it eating grass. But Ibn Ezra himself is unconvinced. But that makes it sound like, okay, it's a regular creature. We may have to debate which regular creature it is, but it's a normal thing that exists in God's world. On the other hand, there's one part where the Leviathan crosses into what sounds like the mythological, where it's going to sound like a fire-breathing creature, which, you know, as far as we know, we don't have. So we're going to have to get to that when we read those sentences. The classic commentators do seem to describe them as common animals, but some of them assign unusual properties to them, presumably based on the following passage in the Talmud. Take a look at number 8, please. Hebrew's on the bottom of one side, English is at the top of the other. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda said, quoting Rav, Kol ma shebara HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba'olamaru zachar unikeva bira'am. Everything God created in this world, He created male and female. Av Leviathan Nachash Bariach veLeviathan Nachash Akalaton. This includes the two references to Leviathan found in Yeshaya in Isaiah chapter 27. Zachar unikeva bara'am. God creates them male and female. And the idea is the Nachash Bariach is the male. That's the beam Leviathan, and then the one that's Akalaton, the curved one, that's the female. But if they would mate, they would destroy the world. So what did God do to avoid a world in which there are leviathans running around, little baby leviathans which become adult leviathans? So what did God do? So He neutered the male and He killed the female. And the Gemara further, I didn't bring you the whole discussion, discusses why that way and not the other way. Why not kill the male? Fine. And He salted away for the righteous in the future. Shneimar, because the Pasuk says, the haragis hatanin asher bayam. It says it there in Yeshaya. He killed the tanin, hence crocodile-alligator association, because that's, you know, where you render tanin usually. And He salted it away for the righteous in the future. Now, you already have a hint here that this is not to be taken literally.
It's a fairy tale world.
Forget the term. How do you know this is not literal? The general rule, when you're dealing with a passage in Medrash, or a general rule anyway, I made it up, so it's Torchino's rule. When you're dealing with Medrash and you want to know, is this to be taken literally or not, is see if the Medrash or the immediate early commentaries to that Medrash pose halachic questions about it. If they don't, it's probably not meant literally. There is a biblical prohibition against neutering an animal. Right? What do people do if they have pets? It's a great halachic question to ask your rabbi. But there's a basic halachic problem with it. You're not allowed to do that. How can God do this to Leviathan? God generally follows the rules that He has set up for us within the Torah. So that's an example. The fact that it's not there, the fact that the commentators don't ask this question on the Gemara itself doesn't say, hey, wait a minute, how did God do that, tells you that this is not something to be taken on a plain level, and we'll see more of that in the Maharal in a few minutes. But that's Leviathan. Now we get to the Behemoth. Va'af behemot b'harei elef, as well as a pasuk in Tehillim, which says the behemoth on 1,000 mountains, or maybe mighty mountains. Zachar unikeva b'ra'am, He created that also male and female. There were multiple behemotot, or whatever you would do. No, behemot is singular here. Right, behemiyot maybe, okay. V'ilmalein is kakin zela zeh machrivin kol ha'olam kulo. And if they would mate also, they would produce baby behemoth, and that would be bad for the world. Ma'asa kadosh baruch hu, what did God do? And it tells us the same thing. He neuters the male. He stores away the female for the future. Shenemar, as the pasuk says, he neinak kocha. I added the word in the brackets. Adayin bimotnav zezachar ba'ono b'shrei bitno zonikeva. The pasuk says it's going to be in our section here. Behold, his strength is in his loins. That's the male, meaning it's still there. He hasn't produced a child. And ditto for the female, that it hasn't yet produced a child. So what you see here in the Gemara is that they don't view these as run-of-the-mill creatures. This is something that is above and beyond, that's created in the beginning, stored away in the beginning, because it would destroy the world, and God's going to use it to reward the righteous at some point in the future. There's a physicist by the name of I.I. Rabi, who was one of the leading physicists of the 20th century. And he wrote his biography. He was Jewish. And he wrote his biography, and he said that he left Judaism when he came to realize that his grandmother believed that there was a lizard that surrounded the world and that God was going to kill it one day and give its flesh to the righteous. That belief in something that to him was just entirely foreign, mythological, he couldn't deal with that. He said, this is not for me. And that he walked away. I have to think there was something else involved. You gotta do better than that. But the problem that he poses is a real problem. Meaning, do we take this literally with this idea that, one day all the righteous people will have this and the wicked will have none? Like, what are we meant to draw from here? So if we had more time than we do, we would have a discussion about it. But I wanted to show you that, generally speaking, this has not been taken as a literal piece at all. Take a look, please, at source number 9, the Maharal of Prague. In his comment to that passage in the Talmud says, "Ein l'chalomar ki hayadas chachamim shiyi aliv yasan begodlo v'chol advar mesher amru chachamim shiyi ezeh beguf." He said, don't think that the sages thought that the Leviathan, with all the different traits, its size and everything else described here in the Talmud, that this is actually a physical thing. And that, we're gonna eat them one day. He says, God forbid, it's just not so. And I'm making a long story short, but you have it there on the sheet. He says, this is meant to say that God created something that will be a reward for the righteous in the future, and that he is holding until then. And he goes on to explain at length how all the different things that we are describing in Leviathan and Behemoth are meant to reflect aspects of the reward that is waiting for those who are loyal to God. That's what this is meant to be about, which then you have to go back to Job and ask yourself, so then why are you describing mythological creatures to Job? Why are you describing to Job something that isn't meant literally at all? And does Job know that they're not meant literally? Does Job think that these are being described as real creatures? Does Job think he's being told about the reward that's waiting for the righteous in Gan Eden? I don't know. Maharal doesn't address it. But I think there's something here in this. It sounds like Maharal believes that it's allegorical even within Job itself. That God is not speaking to Job of creatures as much as he's speaking to Job of ideas. And I think that should be kept in mind as you go through it. But in terms of the point of God highlighting these creatures in particular, which may be literal or which may be allegorical, two different views I'd like to present. One view is like the classic view of God's speeches that we've talked about. This is more about divine power. Look at these really cool things I created. Look what they can do. And I can manage these creatures. Or as Mitzudat David says, and I brought it on the sheet, Job, if I wanted to reward you, I could reward you. If I could control these creatures, there's nothing that's stopping me from rewarding you for your good deeds. Clearly, I have a plan for what I'm doing. But that's problematic. Because most of these speeches, most of the text here in this speech is not going to talk about God's might at all. It's going to be about the grandeur of these animals. It's going to be about the creatures themselves. It's not about God. So I think that's a difficult read. I think the Rambam's read is a stronger read, which is in line with what we've already said about God's speeches, which is that what God is doing is showing the gap between his world and our world. Take a look, please, at source number 11, what I brought you from the Rambam in Mora Nevuchim, in God of the Perplexed. He says, "Verov ma sheherich b'dibur ha'hu hayavatar Leviathan." Most of the speech is going to be about Leviathan, not about Behemoth, which includes within it, I'm just going to go with the English in the interests of time, which includes within it physical abilities, sgulot gashmiot, that are scattered among living creatures that crawl and walk and fly. In other words, the Leviathan, you're going to see traits in it that really sum up all of the different traits found in the animal kingdom. And the intent, as Rambam sees it, is that we can't comprehend the creation of these entities which are found in the world of existence and decay. How can there be such creatures in our world? In other words, the gap between that world and our world demonstrates once again the gap between God and human being, which defies communication. Nusum said the same idea. She didn't quote the Rambam. But take a look at number 12. Where she says it. She says, Job, as was clear from chapters 29 to 31, laid claim to an essential continuity between himself and God. Right? 29 to 31 was where he made his summation, where he said, I was a wonderful person, I helped everybody, now I'm absolutely miserable, and there's no justice in it. I can't see any justice in what God is doing. So he sets up a continuity, like, if God were really just, it would make sense to me. It would all be clear. God is just a more powerful version of what I am. But we should. There is a spectrum. Knowing himself as embodiment and upholder of the order of moral values, he knows God. Here, the non-moral and non-rational aspects of deity, meaning God, are highlighted. Knowing Leviathan, one knows something of the monstrous. That is its own reflection of the numinous. I added in the word translation, spiritual. Holy otherness of God. In other words, once you recognize in Leviathan something that is so foreign from the world of the human being, you can start to have a sense that there are things you don't understand. There are things out there that you just can't relate to. And you can ask for communication, but you ain't going to get it. It's just not a possibility. That's the way that she takes it, which I think reflects the way the Rambam takes it, which is the way I look at these speeches as well. Because again, if these speeches were really about the greatness of God, they would spend time talking about God. And they just don't. So let's see it. We're gonna go through the Behemoth section and then hold Leviathan for next time. All of this is built on, not all of this, a lot of the commentary is built on a pasuk in Tehillim, which we already saw referenced before, the Behemoth Bahare Eleph. It's in Tehillim chapter 50, sentence 10. We're not going to look it up right now, which describes Behemoth on 1,000 mountains, and we're going to say that's the animal we're talking about here. The word Behemoth itself, as I mentioned, Tehillim chapter 50, sentence 10, is the sentence that you're going to want. I mentioned before that Behemoth is considered singular, even though it has the oat ending. The basis for that, and the commentators generally do say that, is the fact that all the verbs for Behemoth here are in the singular. It's going to describe singular down the line in this section. Okay, so take a look at that. It's starting with sentence 15, Pasuk Tedvav. Hine na behemoth asher asiti imach, chatzir kabakar yochel, the behemoth that I created with you. With you meaning either, Ibn Ezra offers two explanations, either it goes on land, as opposed to Leviathan, which is a sea creature, or I created with you back in creation. When you were created, I created these, day six, when I created the animals. And all it eats is grass. Mitzvah David said, and yet it's sustained somehow just on grass alone, right? The hippo is a vegetarian. Yeah. It's an herbivore. And yet it manages to sustain itself somehow on grass. Right? Shout out to Daniel in the seats. It can do it. I wonder if it's also, Job, why are you afraid of these creatures, of the behemoth? It's an herbivore. It's not interested in eating you. Don't know. Its strength is in its loins. Its strength, ono is also a term for its strength, is inside in its belly. Mitzudat David says it has great potential strength, even though it doesn't exert it as a predator. It's not a predator. It just eats grass. Yachpotz zinavo kemo arez. Yachpotz is either to tense up, it tenses up its tail, and its tail is so mighty it's like a cedar tree, or it wags its tail. That's the alternative, like chipazon is the association. Either one is offered.
How about when he wishes?
When he wishes, yachpod zinavo from that. So so Ibn Ezra quotes it and makes fun of it. Ibn Ezra says there are some who render it as yachpotz and ein bo chefetz is his response. He doesn't like it. Yeah, Debbie, what?
It's a mammoth
of some sort.
Well, it's an herbivore.
I don't know if the mammoths were herbivores. Now you have homework. Mammoths were herbivores?
Okay.
Nothing else to say then. Okay. So the its tail is like a cedar. Gidei fachadav yisoragu. The sinews in its loins are braided. It's describing the size of this creature. Atzamav afikei nechusha. Its bones are like copper channels, copper pipes. Gramav kimetil barzel. Gramav is also a reference to bones. They are like lumps of iron. Hu reishis darchei kel. This was the first of the ways of God. Ha'oso yagesh harbo. The one who created it is the one who will wield his sword against it. Meaning only God is able to kill this creature. Rashi suggests the idea that from the beginning it was created at the head of the beasts. It has some kind of a special relationship with God. Kivul harim yis'ulo. V'chayas ha'sadeh yisachak husham. Bul is yivul. Is the grass that grows, the produce. It grazes on that which grows on the mountains, and that takes us back to that sentence in Tehillim in Psalms chapter 50. And all of the beasts of the field laugh fearlessly there. You wouldn't be laughing, Job. But all the animals, they just, you know, they play around with it. And that's your fourth reference to laughter in the divine speeches here. Is the laughter of the creatures around it who are not afraid. They know it's an herbivore. Tachas tselim yishkav. It lives beneath the shadows. Beseser kaneu bitza, in the shelter of the swamps. Yisukuhu tselim tzilalo, which is a nice turn of phrase in the Hebrew. You can hear that tselim tzilalo. The shade shelters it. Yisubuhu arve nachal. It is surrounded by the willows. Hainya shok nahar lo yachpoz. It drinks the river dry without any haste. Yivtach ki yagiach yarden el pio, and it trusts that the Yarden, the Jordan, is going to just make its way to its mouth. Be'enav yikachenu b'mokshim yinikav af. This sentence is a hard one to render. The Mitzudat David says the way to read it is that it drinks, it takes the Yarden back to its source, to its spring. Enav, like ayin, ma'ayan. That it takes it back to its source, the river. And it bumps up its nostrils, or it pierces its nostrils even, against the obstacles that are there in the water. That's one take. Another take is that it's drinking it up with its eyes and drinking it up with its nostrils. That's another rendering that I've seen. Look at Ibn Ezra, Ralbag, if you want to look further on it. There's also a possibility that this sentence may actually start the Leviathan section that some say, but I think not. I think it's the last sentence in Behemoth. So the upshot here is, Job, this is a mighty creature. This is something which is so fearsome in terms of its drinking, in terms of its size, in terms of the amount that it eats. And this is part of God's world. It's a creature that has an association with God. And you, Job, you know, have no comprehension of it. This isn't your world, Job. Shana.
Just a footnote. If Rashi's theory that it's called Behemoth because it is the king of the Behemoth,
yes,
then that would be how titles work. The king of Mitzrayim was called Mitzrayim. The king of Behemoth is called Behemoth.
That's cute. King of Behemoth ends up being called Behemoth. Okay. Then we have to ask why that doesn't carry through. Should Leviathan be called Dagim, for example?
I don't know.
I don't know. if it's not, I don't know who else is. Either that or he's his bodyguard. I don't know. It's an interesting thought for sure. One last note.